Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I'm your host, and today we are doing something a little bit different.
Yeah, we are. I'm excited to be here to help break this one down.
Because we aren't looking at history or tech trends or psychology today. We are zooming in way past the visible world, past the microscope, right down to the fundamental geometric skeleton of matter.
Right, the actual atomic structure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We have a stack of research here that tackles a question that sounds simple on the surface, but is actually, you know, mind-bendingly complex.
How does a solid material change shape without shattering into a million pieces?
That's the one. It is the great paradox of solids, isn't it? We learn in school that crystals are these rigid, perfect grids of atoms, like a military formation.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take a paperclip and bend it, it doesn't snap. It yields. It flows. It holds its new shape.
Right. And the sources we're diving into today argue that this isn't just random atomic scrambling. It's not a mosh pit down there.
No. It's a highly choreographed mathematical dance. And our mission today is to decode that dance. We are looking specifically at a concept called invariant plane strains, or IPS.
IPS. It is essentially the golden rule of deformation, the playbook that atoms follow when they need to move.
Now, invariant plane strain sounds a bit like a repetitive stress injury or a bad day at the gym.
Yeah, it does.
But I gather from the papers that it is significantly more elegant. We want to understand the patterns and how atoms rearrange themselves for you, the listener. So let's start at the very beginning. What exactly does it mean for a strain to have an invariant plane?
So imagine you have a block of material. Let's say a block of jelly or a block of metal. It doesn't matter.
Okay, jelly is easier to picture.
Right, so when you deform it, twist it, pull it, squish it, usually everything moves. Points shift relative to each other. Angles get distorted. Lines get stretched.
It's geometric chaos.
Exactly. But an invariant plane strain is a very specific, disciplined type of deformation. It's one where a single slice through that material, a 2D plane, remains completely unchanged.
Unchanged, like nothing happens to it at all.
Entirely.
Yeah.
It is perfectly undistorted and unrotated. It's the eye of the storm. Everything else is shifting and shearing around it, but that one plane stays perfectly still in terms of its internal geometry.
Okay, I need a visual for that. Because my brain is trying to picture a 3D block where the middle stays still and the rest moves, it's hurting slightly.
The classic analogy, and the one used directly in our sources, is a deck of cards.
Oh, right.
It's really the best way to visualize it. Imagine you have a fresh deck sitting on the table. It's a nice, neat, rectangular block.
Got it.
Now, put your hand on the top card and slide it forward. The cards slide over each other. The shape of the deck changes from a rectangle to a leaning parallelogram.
Right, a simple shear.
Exactly. Now think about the very bottom card, the one touching the table.
It hasn't moved.
It hasn't moved, it hasn't stretched, it hasn't rotated. That plane, the plane of the shear is invariant.
Okay, that clicks perfectly. So the top card moved a lot, the middle card's moved a little, but that specific slice at the bottom remained perfect.
Precisely. And mathematically, the research shows that almost any complex deformation can actually be broken down into two distinct parts.
Right. The pure strain and the rotation.
Yes.
Yeah.
You have the pure strain, which is just expanding or contracting along the squishing part.
Yeah.
And you have a rigid body rotation, which is just spinning the entire object in space.
So it's basically a mix of squishing and spinning.
In a way, yes. Nature combines a specific amount of squish and a specific amount of spin so that they cancel each other out on exactly one plane.
And finding that perfect combination is the key to understanding how crystals like steel or iron transform.
Exactly.
So diving into the research, the source material outlines three distinct flavors of this deformation. Let's walk through them because I think this helps map out the territory for everyone listening.
Sure. The first one is what we call pure dilatational.
Dilatational. That sounds like volume, like eyes dilating. Oh.
It is essentially volume change. This is purely expansion or contraction. The papers give the example of a plate-shaped precipitate, like a little crystal disk growing inside a metal.
Right. By diffusion.
Yes. If the atoms in that disk are bigger than the atoms they are replacing, the plate has to push outwards. It gets thicker.
So it's like a balloon that only inflates in one direction.
That's a great way to put it. The face of the plate is the invariant plane. It doesn't stretch sideways, but the material is thickening perpendicular to it.
Got it. So that's type one. What about type two?
Type two is the simple shear. That's our deck of cards again. There is absolutely no volume change here. The deck doesn't get bigger or heavier. It just changes shape.
This is how macroscopic slip happens in crystals, right? Just layers sliding over layers.
It's hot.
And type three This seems to be the general IPS that the researchers are most excited about.
The general IPS, this is the hybrid. It's where things get really interesting because it's a combination. You have the sliding cards, but you also have a volume change.
So the deck of cards is sliding, but the cards are also, what, shrinking?
We're getting packed tighter, yes. A perfect real-world example of this in the literature is the Martin Siddick transformation of iron.
Specifically when gamma iron turns into epsilon iron.
Right. This is what happens in certain alloys and under high pressure. The crystal structure is changing from face-centered cubic, or FCC, to hexagonal close-packed, or HCP.
And to do this, nature performs a very specific geometric maneuver. I was reading this part. It shears on the 1111 plane.
The 111 plane. That's the most densely packed plane of atoms in the crystal.
Like racking billiard balls.
Exactly like that. It shears in a specific direction, the 112 direction. And here's the detail that just blows my mind.
The math of it.
The math. The magnitude of that shear is exactly 1 divided by the square root of 8.
1 over root 8. That is incredibly precise. It's not about that much. It's exactly that much.
It is geometry and pure action. But that's not all. Because epsilon iron is denser than gamma iron, there is also a volume contraction.
So the atoms slide by that specific fraction, but they also pull tighter together perpendicular to that plane.
Yes.
Now, how do we even know this? I mean, we can't exactly watch individual atoms slide and squeeze with a magnifying glass.
That's the beauty of the experimental side of this research. We have proof through stacking faults. The source mentions that if you have a single shockly partial dislocation.
Which is just a glitch in the stacking sequence, right?
Exactly. Don't worry about the jargon. Just think of it as a glitch in the matrix. That glitch creates a tiny region of that HCP structure.
A glitch that is exactly 3 atomic layers thick.
3 layers.
That's barely anything. That is less than a nanometer.
It is incredibly tiny. And for a long time, it was hard to prove this model because 3 layers is barely enough to diffract electrons. But electron diffraction experiments finally detected it.
They saw the specific volume change.
They saw a specific contrast that shouldn't be there unless the interplanar spacing had changed. They proved the atoms weren't just sliding, they were packing tighter.
Confirming that specific general IPS model down to the individual atom.
That is wild. It confirms these aren't just abstract mathematical models on a chalkboard. The atoms are obeying these rules.
Down to the nanometer.
Okay, so that's one way crystals deform this, sliding and squeezing. But there's another big concept in our stack of papers here. Mechanical twinning. Now, this sounds like cloning, but I assume it's not biological.
Not quite cloning, no. It's more like a mirror image. Mechanical twinning is a homogeneous shear where part of the parent crystal lattice suddenly flips into a twin orientation.
So it's literally like half the crystal decides to look in the mirror.
Visually, yes.
Yeah.
And the boundary between the parent part and the flipped twin part is, you guessed it, the invariant plane. It connects them perfectly.
Let's deep dive into the FCC twinning mentioned in the text. How does this flipping actually happen at the atomic level?
It comes down to the stacking sequence again. Imagine you're stacking oranges at the grocery store. In an FCC crystal, the layers go in a simple repeating pattern, A, B, C, A, B, C.
Okay, easy enough. When twinning happens, that sequence shifts. It becomes A, B, C, and then suddenly A, B, A, C, B, A.
It reflects.
It reflects. The sequence reverses order after the boundary.
And why does the crystal do this? Is it just bored?
It's usually reacting to stress. But here's the fascinating part highlighted in the research. Nature is lazy, or efficient, if you prefer.
I prefer efficient.
Fair enough. The hypothesis is that crystals will always choose the twinning mode that requires the smallest possible shear.
Because shearing takes energy. Changing shape stretches the bonds between atoms, which creates elastic distortion and strain energy.
Exactly. The crystal wants to minimize that energy bill. So for FCC crystals, the math tells us the winning mode, the cheapest option, is on those 111 planes in the 112 direction.
And the source gives us a specific number for this budget shear, right?
It does. The magnitude is S equals 1 over the square root of 2. That works out to about 0.707.
0.707.
Now, mathematically, you could achieve a twin reflection with a completely different shear. You could shear it by a magnitude of the square root of 2.
Which is 1.414. So double the size.
Right. And while it works perfectly on paper to create the mirror image, we never see it in reality.
Because it's too expensive energetically.
Yes. The crystal completely refuses to do that much work when a smaller shear achieves the exact same structural result.
I love that. Atoms are budget conscious. They're saying, we're not paying 1.414 when we can get it for 0.707.
It's the pure economy of thermodynamics.
So we've got these crystals shearing and twinning, but what does this look like in the lab? The source describes a really interesting case study involving a tensile test on a single crystal of iron. I think this bridges the gap between atomic theory and real-world bending for you listening at home.
It's a great example. Imagine you have a single crystal rod of ferrite that's BCC iron, and you put it in a machine to pull it apart. A standard tensile test.
Okay, I'm pulling the ends. Logic says it just gets longer and thinner.
It gets longer, yes. But here is the structural conflict. The machine holds the ends in clamps. Those ends have to stay aligned vertically. But inside the crystal, the atoms actually want to slide on a diagonal plane.
So if the crystal wants to slide diagonally, but the machine forces it to stay straight, something has to give.
And that something is rotation. The crystal lattice itself actually rotates relative to the tensile axis. The axis effectively moves toward the shear direction.
The source mentions a really clear visual for this. If the specimen is thin enough, it doesn't just stay a rod. It bends.
It bends into an S shape. It's a very distinct curve because the ends are fixed by the clamps, but the middle is actively rotating and shearing.
There's a specific calculation here in the paper that I want to unpack. It talks about an axis starting at 441 and rotating.
Yes, this is a beautiful example of how drastic this rotation can be. The tensile axis starts at the crystallographic direction 441. Due to twinning, it rotates all the way to become parallel to 343 or 44.
343 or 44. That sounds like a massive internal shift.
It corresponds to a measured plastic strain of 240 or 40%. So the crystal has stretched by 40%, and the internal atomic map has swung wildly to accommodate that stretch while keeping the ends aligned.
And this movement isn't always smooth sailing, is it? The text mentions these two phases, easy glide versus duplex slip. It sounds like traffic conditions.
It's very similar to traffic. Easy glide is exactly what it sounds like. The crystal is oriented such that only one slip system, one specific plane and direction is active.
Like an empty highway.
Exactly. The dislocation just slides out. Resistance is very low.
Smooth.
But as the crystal rotates, like we just discussed, the orientation changes. Eventually, the tensile axis hits a boundary on the stereographic triangle.
And the stereographic triangle, for those listening, that's essentially the map of crystal orientations.
Correct. When it hits that boundary on the map, suddenly a second slip system becomes just as stressed as the first one. Now you have two highways opening up at once, intersecting each other.
Duplex it.
And that is a traffic jam. The dislocations from one system physically interfere with the other. They get tangled. They block each other. And the work hardening rate, the force you need to keep deforming the metal, drastically increases.
So it's easy going until you hit that boundary, and then suddenly the material fights back hard.
Exactly.
Okay, moving on to something that really caught my eye in these papers. Stepped interfaces. We've been talking about these invariant planes like they're perfectly smooth sheets of glass. But reality is messy. What happens when there's a step in the boundary?
This gets into some really clever theoretical physics from the authors. They discuss what they call virtual operations. It's a thought experiment to define the mathematics of a step.
Walk us through it. I want to make sure we picture this right.
Imagine you have a crystal. First, you cut it. Then you shear the faces relative to each other. Then you re-weld it.
Sounds like atomic surgery.
It's a Volterra-like process. By doing this thought experiment, you can calculate the closure failure in a circuit around that step. That failure gives you the Burgers vector.
The Burgers vector being the mathematical description of the distortion caused by that step. It's amazing that scientists have to essentially break the crystal in their imagination to understand the math of it. But why does this matter practically? What happens when a real dislocation hits a real boundary?
That is the big question. When a slip dislocation hits a coherent twin boundary, does it stop or does it go through?
My intuition says a boundary is a wall. Things should get stuck.
That's what we always thought. But the equation derived from these virtual operations tells a completely different story. The source reveals that in FCC metals like copper or austenitic steel, there are essentially no geometrical restrictions for dislocations crossing one of whole two-man twin boundaries.
Wait, really? So the wall isn't a wall?
It's more like a ghost walking through a wall. Because the glide planes in the twin and the parent meet edge to edge, and the Burgers vectors transfer perfectly, the dislocation can decompose, slide through, and reform on the other side.
This busts a pretty big myth in material science, doesn't it? The source goes deep into martensite and its strength.
Yes, this is the climax of the paper, in my opinion. For a long time, it was thought that the incredibly high strength of ferrous martensite, which is hardened steel, came from the fact that it was full of these fine twins blocking slip.
Because if the twins are walls and the dislocations can't move, the metal is hard. That makes intuitive sense.
That was the logic. But as we just saw, dislocations can pass through these twin boundaries relatively easily, so the twins cannot be the main source of the strength.
So why is quenched steel so hard then? If it's not the twins stopping the flow, what is it?
It turns out the real culprit is the carbon. It's solid solution hardening. The interstitial carbon atoms stuck in the lattice gaps are what actually pin the dislocations.
So it's the invisible atoms hiding in the gaps, not the highly visible twin walls.
Precisely. And the evidence they present is compelling. The source points to an iron-nickel alloy, F-13A. When you quench it, it forms these same beautiful twins. But it has almost no carbon.
And is it hard?
It's soft. It has the twins, but not the carbon, and it's simply not strong.
That completely flips the script. We look at the microstructure, we see the twins, and we assume they're doing all the work. But it's actually the chemistry, the invisible carbon, doing the heavy lifting.
It forces you to look at the chemistry, not just the geometry. It's a classic case of correlation not implying causation.
Speaking of geometry, we have one final, slightly terrifying topic from the stack to unpack. The martensitic transformation models. The Bain strain versus the triclinic model.
This is deep crystallography. The Bain strain is the classic textbook idea. You take an FCC cube, you compress one axis and expand the other two, and voila, you have a BCC or body-centered cubic shape. It's simple, it's elegant.
But our source suggests it's maybe a little too simple.
The source introduces an alternative, the triclinic correspondence model. Instead of just squishing and pulling, this model involves two specific shears, let's call them S1 and S2, combined with expansions and contractions.
That sounds much more complicated. Why make it complicated if the simple one works?
Because it might better reflect the actual atomic pathway the material takes. But what's really cool is how they analyze it. They factorize the strain.
Which brings us right back to the start of the deep dive.
Yeah.
Separating the squish from the spin.
Exactly. Any complex deformation can be broken down into a pure strain, the distortion, and a rigid body rotation.
They did a calculation in the text. For a cobalt iron alloy, Co6.5E, what did they find when they ran the numbers on this complex triclinic model?
They found something surprisingly efficient. Despite the major structural change from FCC to HCP, the maximum extension or contraction of any vector was actually less than 20%.
Less than 20%. That seems incredibly small for a whole crystal changing its entire structure.
It is surprisingly gentle. Nature finds a path where the atoms don't have to stretch too far, and the rotation. This specific transformation involved a rotation of about 10.03 degrees.
10.03 degrees. I love the precision of that. It shows that even in this violent atomic reshuffling, there is a strict mathematical order.
Absolutely. The atoms aren't just scrambling. They're following a very tight choreography to minimize energy at every step.
So we've gone from sliding a deck of cards to specific atomic rotations in cobalt iron alloys. We've busted the myth of martensite strength and learned that nature is shockingly budget conscious with energy. It's been quite a journey through these sources.
It really highlights that materials don't just squish when you push them. They have preferred modes. They slide, they rotate, and they twin along these very specific, mathematically predictable invariant planes.
And for me, the biggest takeaway from all these papers is humility in the face of the microstructure. It's humbling to realize that for decades, we might look at a microstructure, see all these twin boundaries, and assume, aha, that's the wall stopping the dislocations, only to find out the walls are permeable and it's the invisible carbon atoms doing the real work.
It is a great reminder that in materials science, and really in all science, intuition is just the starting point. You have to do the math, you have to check the Burgers vectors, you have to verify if the wall is actually a wall or just a door painted to look like one.
A door painted to look like a wall. I like that. It leaves you with a really provocative thought to mull over. If boundaries like twins don't actually stop dislocations in many cases, we have to rethink our intuition about what makes materials hard. It makes me wonder what else in the material world we are totally misinterpreting, because we're focused on the big, visible features instead of the tiny, invisible details hiding in the lattice.
That is always the question. We need to look closer at the atomic friction, the solutes, the things you can't easily see.
Something for you to think about the next time you look at a steel beam, or even just bend a paperclip. You now know the atomic gymnastics happening inside. Thank you for guiding us through this atomic landscape today.
My pleasure. It's a beautiful world down there.
And thank you for listening to this deep dive Until next time, keep looking beneath the surface.